staring back the way they'd come toward Sharrakai, wondering how many of the king's ships were looking for them. Sumeya turned to Melisse just as they were setting sail once more.
"They claim we're part of the host."
Her voice was rough as quarry stone.
"That we've always been part of the host."
Melisse stared at her woodenly, as if she were ready to accept whatever punishment the gods saw fit to deliver.
"What matter the label they give us? My father will agree with them."
She stared at her hands, gripping them over and over again.
"He'll bow his head in shame and admit that his daughter was lured by the moonless host. What matter is that?"
Melisse repeated, angry now.
"Because this may all be for nothing. They'll still hide the truth. They'll mark us as traitors. Kill us if they can. But if not, they'll claim we're nothing more than mouthpieces for the Alaf Wakadar. My father will retain his hold on the Asiram. And if any question him, if they investigate the Asiram, he'll simply mask the true story, as he did with us."
Melisse stood in a rush of movement.
"Well, of course he will, you bloody stupid mule. What did you think was going to happen?"
She looked completely impotent, shivering there like that. Jada could tell she wanted to storm away, but they were on a god-damned skiff. Still, she went as far as she could. She stepped over the front thwart, knocking Zaid aside as she did so, and sat at the prow, her legs dangling over the front of the skiff.
"Now be quiet, as the apothecary bade you."
But it wasn't more than a few breaths before Sumeya spoke again.
"We have to go back."
She turned to Darzada, who sat at the tiller, and shouted,
"We have to go back!"
Jada, resting along the bottom of the skiff, her back to the hull, said,
"We can't."
Sumeya went on as if she hadn't spoken.
"If we return now, we'll be able to spread word before my father can poison the House of Maidens against us." "We can't," Jada said. "We will!"
She stood and pointed at Darzada, one hand on the hilt of her sword.
"Turn this skiff around!"
Darzada stared at her with indifferent eyes, then returned to watching the way ahead.
"Turn this skiff around!"
Sumeya's words came out in a long rattle. She tried to pull out her sword, but Jada snatched Sumeya's wrist.
"We are returning to the 13th tribe," Jada said, "where we will help with the effort against Onor."
Sumeya looked incensed. She tried to pull her shamshir again, more forcefully this time, but it was merely a feint. She pushed Jada back enough that she could lift her foot and snap a kick into Jada's chest. Jada flew over the edge of the skiff, struck the sand hard, and rolled to a painful stop. As she was coming to her feet, she saw Sumeya leap over the side, drawing her blade as she went. Jada drew River's daughter, and the two of them met, crossing blades, as the skiff sailed on. Sumeya spoke between wild and mighty swings of her blade, her voice little better than a wolf's growl.
"The kings must answer for what they've done. They must explain it to those they've wronged. They must free the Asiram." "These things they will never do," Jada said, retreating quickly, lithely, always remaining clear of Sumeya's sword.
Sumeya fought like a child new to swordplay. Her swings were born of rage and shame, and the sudden shift from a position of power to one of staggering impotence. Eventually she stopped, breathing hard, and bent over. Then she arched her back and howled at the sky. For a long time she raged, and then dropped to her knees and drove the edge of her blade down into the sand over and over again. The sand splashed around her, flew in arcs above her, until finally Sumeya's energy was spent. She lifted her eyes and regarded Jada with a look of pure revulsion.
"I rue the day you darkened our door."
"There are many wrongs to right in the desert, Sumeya,"
Chader pointed eastward. And one lies that way. Onur is alone, isolated from the other kings. He is not weak, but neither does he command a force that can stop my people if we strike quickly. She stepped closer. Surely you have no love for the King of Sloth. Let us go, you and I. Let us cut him from the roots of his power and free the tribes beneath his yoke. Then we can decide what to do about Sharrakai. Sumer still seemed lost, but at Chader's words, one of her defining features returned. Her authority, her command. She stood and looked out over the eastern reaches of the desert.
Very well, she whispered,
and trudged toward the skiff, which had come to a stop some distance away. They sailed well beyond sunset, but were forced to anchor when twilight faded. They ate a cold meal of hardtack and smoked meat that was as tough and tasty as saddle leather. The desert was fiercely cold that night, and the wind was strong, but they reckoned it was still too dangerous to light a fire. So they laid out blankets in the lee of the skiff and suffered through the night. When the sun rose and they were ready to sail, Chader forestalled them.
I must speak to Zaid about Amalos before we go.
Sumer and Melis shared a look. Dud Sada frowned. Zaid had been shaking her blanket free of sand, but stopped as if she'd known this moment would come.
What good will it do to dredge up the past?
Chader's mouth fell open.
You would dare say that, when our own history was nearly lost to the desert? Who is Amalos?
Melis asked.
A collegiate master,
Chader said before Zaid could speak a word.
A learned man who knew much of the city's history. He agreed to help us uncover the truth, but was discovered when Usam saw him in one of his visions.
Zaid snapped her blanket once, then rolled it tightly.
What happened to Amalos was unfortunate. Unfortunate?
Chader could hardly believe her ears. Master Amalos had helped both Chader and Zaid research the kings and their history. He had discovered invaluable insights in the Khalija's archives, and shared his wisdom with Chader on many a long night as they had pored over various texts, looking for clues as to how Chader could use King Mesut's bloody verse to gain an advantage over him. In the end, Amalos had found the very revelation, written on a beaten sheet of copper, that Chader had used to gain mastery over the whites summoned from Mesut's onyx bracelet. His brave actions had led directly to Mesut's death, but King Usam had seen it in his mirror. A squad of silver spears were sent to apprehend Amalos. Amalos managed to escape by fleeing into the tunnels beneath the city, but his lifeless body was found a short while later, a knife wound to his gut. Chader was nearly certain Zaid had played a part in it.
Amalos came to you for help, Chader said, reliving her anger. He knew the risks,
Zaid replied easily.
He came to you for help, and you murdered him for it. Don't deny it. King Usam told me what he saw. A woman in a white cowl, the flash of a knife in the darkness, a dress stained red.
Zaid looked awkwardly to Sumer and Melis. She didn't appear shamed exactly, but nervous to be speaking of such things before two women who would only a few days ago have strung her high for uttering them.
I had to kill him.
Chader's heart beat madly.
What?
Zaid's eyes had gone distant. She looked afraid and small.
The silver spears had found Amalos in his study below the archive tower. When he escaped and came to me, I brought it to Isan.
Isan? Melis broke in.
By the gods who breathe, why?
Isan has been pulling her strings for years, Jada said. He's been working to topple the other kings so that he can stand upon Toriat alone, without answering to other men. Zaid held the blanket under one arm and picked at the frayed edges. She at least had the decency to look miserable while doing it.
Amalos became a scarab the moment he agreed to help you.
To help us, Jada corrected. For the first time, Zaid seemed flustered.
Of course, us.
Did Isan command you to do it?
Of course he did, Zaid said. If Amalos was discovered as a scarab, it would...
No. Did he command you to do it? She was referring to Isan's ability to command others. Isan used it sparingly, but Jada hoped he had used it here. She hadn't wanted to believe that Zaid would do such a callous thing of her own accord, but after hearing her speak, Jada was nearly certain Isan hadn't commanded her, but simply appealed to fear.
If Amalos had been taken by the kings, Zaid said, it would have ruined everything. I would have been taken and tortured. So would you. And Isan, can you not see? We would have lost our greatest tool.
Jada laughed. You call Isan a tool when you're the one he's been playing like a harp?
I gave him only enough to help him destroy the other kings.
And yet he managed to get you to kill an ally with but a word. Had you, Sam, not shown me Amalos's body, I would never have learned enough to kill Misut.
At this, Melisse stood and stared at them all. Dadzada, Cheda, Zaid, and finally Sumeya. She shook her head as if she were about to speak, then walked away.
Cheda, Dadzada said. Keeping Isan as our ally was an opportunity we couldn't allow to pass us by.
That isn't what I'm talking about. Do you think I care that we're using Isan to destroy the other kings? I'll use any of them, if it will see them wiped from the face of the desert. But you, she said to Zaid, took your knife to a man who came to you for help, a man who trusted you, who might have helped us further. You could have seen him to a safe house. He could have joined the tribe in the desert.
Isan would have known.
Tears crept down her cheeks, sometimes side-slipping along the wrinkles in her aged skin. They looked like shards of citrine in the morning sun. Jada spit into the sand between them.
I name you coward, Zaid. Honorava, you should have seen Amalos free or died trying.
Jada had never seen her like this. Zaid seemed lost, a woman adrift. She blinked away more tears and nodded. With a stricken look, she turned, walked to the skiff and began lifting the mast into place. Sumeya stepped inside the hull to help her. Jada watched them, furious that Zaid chose not to fight her, nor to offer some sort of explanation for her actions. But what could Zaid say? There was no defending what she had done. Strangely, Cheda felt no better after her tirade.
Come with me,
Dadzada said.
I'm not going to listen as you try to soften what she did, she shot back. You're not my bloody father!
Always so fucking stubborn.
And who taught me that?
Your mother did. But I thought some of it might have been drummed out of you in the House of Maidens. I see now I was foolish to think you'd learned to shut that mule mouth of yours and listen to those who are trying to help you.
And who is that?
You, a man who hides things from me as often as the sun shines in the desert. She stabbed her finger toward Zaid.
Or that one. A woman who would sacrifice anyone so long as she isn't found out.
Dadzada motioned to her right hand.
That woman saved you when no one else could. She gave you those tattoos and fought to keep you in the House of Maidens when she could easily have denied my request. And then she fought to keep you there, to ensure you were given an ebon blade, to train you herself, so that you would be ready for all that lay ahead. She might have handled Amalos differently. From what little I knew of him, he was a good man, and I wish he was still with us. But if it came down to a choice of either you or Amalos, I'd choose you every time.
But it didn't have to be that way.
You have no idea how it had to be! Zaid has been maneuvering around the kings for longer than you've been alive. If she thought it necessary, then I believe her.
I won't work with her anymore, Dadsada.
She can't tell us much about Onur.
Her own father.
You think you know so much.
I know the ties of blood are strong.
Moho, are you saying you'd stay your sword if you knew who your father was?
No.
Did she ever share with you the tale of her mother?
No. Chayda admitted, her voice softer. Dadzada maneuvered his bulk toward the skiff.
Perhaps you should ask her about it before you start strutting across the sand, claiming she's wasting lives.
Chapter 50 Chayda and the others set sail shortly after and headed east over the next several days. Fearing the king's navy, they pushed past the first few oases and stretched their water to the limit, making for a small oasis not regularly visited. As they were nearing it, they reached a swathe of desert littered with patches of stone. It was treacherous for any ship larger than a yacht, but perfectly navigable for a skiff. When they reached the oasis, little more than a gully surrounded by a burst of green vegetation, they began to breathe easier. 10 days had passed since their escape from the blooming fields. They huddled in the lee of a tall misshapen boulder, warming themselves by a fire, the first they'd dared on their voyage. Chayda sat cross-legged on the sand, basking in the fire's warmth, while oiling River's daughter. It was strangely comforting to have the blade back, even after so short a separation.
I thought I'd lost you for good,
Chayda mused, as she ran the oily rag up and down the blade.
You're giving it enough oil to drown it,
Sumeya said from across the fire. She'd been resting her voice, but it still sounded terrible.
I know, Chayda replied. But I owe it this much. Well, you're not a whore from the southern docks, Melis snapped. And that isn't a cock. Wipe it dry and be done with it.
Chayda's only reply was to rub it as if she were holding a cock, slow at first and faster, the hilt resting along her crutch. Melis scowled, but Sumeya laughed. A moment later, when Chayda threw her head back and screamed in false pleasure, Melis's scowl softened, and then she was laughing louder than Sumeya. Dadzada rolled his eyes, while Zaid ignored everyone.
I never thanked you, Chayda said to Sumeya.
With the hint of a smile, she said,
You still haven't.
Chayda laughed. She lifted the sword, pinching the blade on either side of the balance point, and lifted it to her forehead.
My life in your debt.
At this, Sumeya's smile turned genuine. Then her eyes narrowed and she seemed to come to a decision. She stood, moved over to the skiff, and grabbed the bag Chayda had retrieved from White Knife's back.
In that case, you're about to owe me your next life as well.
From within the bag, she took out a small, leather-bound book. Its features were lost in shadow, but when Sumeya held it out for her and the firelight struck its worn surface, Chayda saw it for what it was. Her mother's book. It was surreal accepting it from Sumeya, feeling its familiar heft, opening the pages and reading the first of the many poems within.
Tears came unbidden to her eyes.
But it was lost in the desert.
It was found during the search for you and brought to me.
Chayda thumbed through the pages, lingering on several with marks in the gutters. Those were the pages that hid a piece of a bloody verse in plain sight. She tipped the book down so she could see better, and saw them. The places where her mother had re-inked the words with brown ink, and indicated that it was one of the words in Kulishan's poem, the one that had led to his downfall. A tear slipped from her cheek and fell against the page. She quickly wiped it from the paper's rough surface, then dried her tears with a sleeve.
"My life in your debt,"
she said again, this time with perfect sincerity. While Dardzada and Zaid began preparing food, Chayda read through the book, savoring every word. She remembered those rare, lazy days, she and her mother sitting and reading together, sipping rosewater lemonade from the roof of the latest West End tenement to be called home. Dardzada's words from the other day returned to her, his urging her to learn more of Zaid's past before she passed judgment.
"You know of my mother," she said to Zaid, "but I've never heard of yours."
Zaid, sitting across the fire from her, glared at Dardzada. He shrugged.
"She deserves to know,"
and went back to sprinkling salt over a pair of large-skinned lizards. Whatever small amount of annoyance Zaid had been harboring lately faded, and her eyes drifted back to the flickering fire.
"What does it matter?"
Chayda closed the book and put it into the pouch at her belt. Its weight felt right and pure.
"Above all, the desert is a tale of blood, and I would hear yours."
Still Zaid balked.
"If what they've said is true," Sumer rasped, "we may meet your father in battle. I think it's time we all heard."
Zaid's look of indignation spoke of a different time, when she had been the one in charge. But the look soon faded and she began to speak.
"Onur is, and always has been, a cruel, detestable man, especially to my mother. He refused to let her leave his palace. She knew she couldn't disobey him, so she began calling others to come to her, her distant family from the desert among them. I was young then, perhaps 10. It was when I first met Dardzada."
She looked at him and he nodded, allowing that she should tell the full story.
"I met many from the 13th tribe in those days, though I had yet to learn what it meant. I might even have met your grandfather, Ishak," she said to Chayda, "though if so, I can no longer recall. One of my family was a seer, Imarin, my aunt, and she saw some potential in me, which she began to hone over the months and years that followed. I began to read the palms of my friends, and I generally saw in them paths that would take them to fruitful places. They were mostly the children of Golden Hill, after all. I did it occasionally for those who came from the desert. When I became more confident, I desperately wanted to read my mother's palm. Most days she was miserable, and I hoped to find happier days for her and tell her about them. She refused with a fierceness that made me realize it was fear that drove her decision, fear that ran deeper than the roots of Toriat. For many years I didn't dare ask again, afraid of what I might see. But then one day I heard our maids speaking in low tones. One of them was crying, the other trying to console her. I snuck into the dining hall, and the girl who was crying said that Thian, her brother, a most beautiful man who worked in the stables, had displeased the king. Onur had come to ride with a Malasani prince. Theon had ridden out to the desert with them and a dozen courtiers from Malasan and Sharakai. They rode quickly, too fast for the horses on such a hot day and for such a long ride. Onuo was so large his horse grew tired more rapidly than the others, but Onuo refused to slow their pace. Soon his horse, a fine Akala, was staggering, and Theon offered Onuo his own horse.
"Why?" Onuo asked. "Mine is doing well enough."
And then Theon lied in hopes of allowing the king to save face in front of his guests.
"A thousand apologies, my lord king. In my haste to make the horses ready, I forgot to give him a proper ration of water before we left."
"Nonsense,"
replied Onuo, his voice full of disdain. Then he looked to those gathered and spurred his horse into action.
"This Akala could deliver me to Ishmantep and back, I assure you."
The horse collapsed not a half league later. Onuo was thrown from his saddle and was cut along his forehead, a mark that can still be seen today. In his anger he drew his sword, ready to kill the beast that had failed him, but Theon shouted, "No!" and put himself between Akala and the king.
"My lord king, this is all my fault. Please take my horse. I'll remain here until yours recovers from this interminable heat."
It was a grave mistake, and Theon knew it from the start, but what was he to do? Onuo smiled. "You've met him now, you know the sort of smile I mean. Hungry, covetous."
"Very well," my father said to Theon. "Bring the horse to my palace on your return. I would speak to you of how you're keeping them."
Theon had done as Onuo asked, but hadn't yet returned, and now the maids were worried. "Surely he'll be home soon," I said to them, coming out of my hiding place, but they shushed me and sent me away with barely concealed horror on their faces. I found out why that night. My mother had been gone the entire day, summoned to attend Onuo. When she returned, I found her sitting in a chair staring at the window. She wasn't crying, but she was haunted. I've never seen the like, as if her very soul had been taken from her.
Said slowed and then stopped. She turned to face Chayda. Throughout the story, she'd spoken in a distant way, as if it were an ancient tale told a thousand times, over a thousand fires. But now, as she paused, gathering herself, her eyes flitted to and fro, as if she were reliving those fearful moments.
I asked my mother what had happened, and she held out her hand to me, her palm.
A chill settled inside Chayda. A feeling as cold as the winter sky. "What did you do?" Zaid's distant gaze focused on Chayda once more.
"I shook my head and pleaded with her, but she was adamant."
"You will know the sort of man your father is."
"In the end, I was weak. I took her hand and read her palm. It was the strongest vision I have ever had. Then or since. I saw her secreting a slim blade in her shoe. I saw her going to Onuo in his palace. I saw her stab him, but she managed only one strike, and then Onuo had her. For all his weight, he is a powerful man, stronger even than Husa Mateen, and he broke her. I saw nothing after that. I begged my mother not to leave. When she refused, I tried to run from my room, but she held my wrists, gripping them so tightly her nails tore my skin. She made me stare into her eyes, eyes filled with hate and regret and so much sorrow. More than anything, though, I saw her resignation.
You know it will be so, she hissed at me. So do not fight it.
In the days after, I learned that she and Theon had been lovers, I knew she cared for him, but callow as I was, I had no concept of a wife being unfaithful. My mother was a careful woman, more careful than I'd ever given her credit for. What she shared with me next shook me to my very core. You may have heard rumors of Onur, the feasting king. That he eats his will, and that his will is great. That he feasts on the bloody flesh of horses and goats and all manner of beasts. He has other, more abhorrent tastes as well.
Said's lips became a thin line.
Onur had learned of my mother's misdeeds and contrived to bring Theon to him, and then summoned my mother to sup.
Chaja's hand shot to her mouth, but Said seemed utterly composed, which only magnified Chaja's horror.
Onur forced her to sit by his side, two blade maidens standing behind her chair, while he ate and spoke of the weather, how very hot it had been on their ride, how kind Theon had been to give up his own horse, even if he had erred in not preparing Onur's horse properly. Never once did he mention that he knew she and Theon had been lovers, nor did he ask her to his bed, thank the gods, or I might never have seen her again. My mother refused to eat. You can guess why. And she feared he would force her. But he merely waved his fork to the meat on her plate, asking her why she wasn't hungry. He left her in that room after a kiss to the back of her hand.
Zaid's chin quavered.
My mother left that night, hours after I had read her palm. She went to Onur's palace and never returned. She was never even given a funeral. To this day, I don't know where her bones are buried, if they even are.
The way she said it was so pitiful it made Chaida's arms and shoulders curl inward. Zaid noticed. She looked to the others, who looked stricken as well, even Dardzada, who knew the story already. She forged on, as if the simple act of acknowledging their sadness would be to give in to her own.
I had no idea that I was one of the 13th tribe. I'd only heard whispers of its existence. But after learning of my mother's death, my aunt Imarine told me all of it. Our story in the days leading up to Bet Iman, of the massacre, of our blood being sheltered among the remaining 12 tribes, of the origins of the Moonless Host, which was born from hatred of the kings, but also of a thirst for revenge.
For long moments, it was all Chaida could do to keep the knot in her throat from getting worse.
Why did your mother never tell you of your heritage?
A question I've asked myself many times. There was no time to ask her then.
Zaid shrugged.
And she would have refused to answer in any case. I suspect she hoped to protect me from it. She felt the fight was just, but one that had little to do with her. Like so many in Sharrakhai and even the desert, she was part of the Silent Horde. Were they to rise up, they could overthrow the kings tomorrow, but they will not. Their fear neuters them.
Melis had grown more and more restless.
Not everyone on Golden Hill is like Onur, she said.
Perhaps not, Zaid replied. But they're not the ones in power, are they?
They could be,
Melis fired back.
The cause of the 13th tribe may be just, but that doesn't mean everyone on Toriad should be hung for the king's crimes.
Dardzada scowled.
You're suggesting the heirs should take their thrones.
Why not? Melis replied. They have a legitimate right to them.
Dardzada lifted the lizards he had been roasting and turned them over.
You speak of rights. What of the new tribe forming in the desert? What of the Asiram?
Usually Cheda would stand right beside Dardzada and join in, but she was weary of fighting, and the last thing they needed was an argument. So before Melisse could respond, Cheda asked Said,
"Isan shared Honor's bloody verse with me, that he's weakened after he feasts. Is it so?"
Said considered it a while, then shrugged.
"He's long been known for taking days, even weeks, to hide away, allowing none near him. Perhaps that's due to his verse, but it could also be because he hates everyone he lays eyes on."
"Isan also said he's a skin changer?"
"I've heard rumors."
Zaid waggled her head, an expression of impotence.
"I should know more. He's my father, but after my mother, I couldn't bear to be near him."
As Zaid spoke, Cheda felt something strange. A sense of worry had been growing inside her, and it now felt markedly worse. She wasn't even sure why, but she felt suddenly unsafe. She reached out into the night. She easily found the others around the fire, the kettle drum of Dardzada's heart, the other women's hearts playing a lighter rhythm around it. There was something else, though, a beat on the edge of perception. She thought it might be a drake hidden beneath the sand's surface. With sudden clarity, she understood. The heartbeat was faint because it was being concealed.
"Danger!"
Cheda whistled as she stood, River's daughter in her hand. She heard a rapid patter of footsteps moments before she saw a figure resolve from the darkness. It was a woman dressed in black, an ebon sword held in her hands, a turban and veil hiding her face. Melisse and Sumeya were already up, ebon blades at the ready. Zaid had turned the opposite direction, perhaps sensing another. Dardzada was lumbering to his feet as Cheda moved to intercept the blade maiden.
"Traitors!" cried the maiden as she came. "Gods, it was Indris."
Cheda had no time to wonder how she had found them.
"The skiff!"
Cheda said to Dardzada. He was already on the move as Cheda's sword met Indris's. The two of them traded blows, Cheda's fueled by desperation, Indris's by hatred. Indris had been masking her heartbeat, inexpertly, or Cheda would never have sensed her, but Cheda knew that where there was one, there would be more. Beyond the drumming of her own heart, Cheda felt them approaching. Four more, each trying to mask themselves. She was about to warn the others when Sumeya whistled.
"Enemies! Surrounded!"
Sumeya intercepted the first of the newcomers. Melisse took another. Zaid met a third. As the sound of clashing steel filled the night, a fifth came rushing toward the skiff.
"Dardzada!"
she shouted without turning toward him. As she swung River's daughter up in a sweeping block, Dardzada's heavy grunt came from behind her. A moment later there was a pop and then a flash of light that was so bright it drowned the feeble campfire. A sizzling sound was followed by a muffled scream from the blade maiden. Again and again Indris tried to slip inside Cheda's guard. She found no openings, but neither did Cheda, and she backed away. Indris had grown in skill. She had become stronger in the ways of the heart as well. Cheda tried to press against her heart, but was unable to pin her down. Indris did not attack Cheda in this way, but she'd grown adept in defending against it. From the corner of her eye, Cheda saw a blade maiden rolling over the sand near the skiff. She was screaming, her hands pressed tightly against her eyes. The skiff itself was just beginning to shift. A high-pitched moan accompanied the movement. It was coming from Dardzada as he leaned his bulk against the rear of the skiff and pushed backward with his legs. His heartbeat was spiking. It was pounding faster than Cheda's. He was clearly wounded, but how badly?
Indris tried to rush toward him, but Chayda cut her off. She blocked Indris's high swing and snapped a kick into her midsection. When Indris dodged left, placing the fire between them, Chayda kicked the coals into her face. Embers flew up, and Indris reeled, her arms going up to protect her face as Chayda turned and ran for the skiff. It was heading down the far side of the dune, picking up speed.
"Orderly retreat," Chayda whistled. "Toward me."
Sumeya, Melisse, and Zaid moved into a rough line and began backing up toward Chayda. There would be no easy escape onto the skiff this time, not until they had managed to slow the maidens. As a mighty groan came from the skiff, Dardzada lifting the mast into place, Zaid released a loud ki-ai, then another. She was engaged with an imposing blade maiden. Camille, Chayda realized, who towered over Zaid. Zaid, who had only a small buckler to defend herself, was using it with ever more desperation. Chayda knew as well as anyone how powerful Camille's swings were. Chayda lost track of Zaid as they began to retreat more quickly. As the fire was lost from view behind the dune, however, and their opponents were outlined by the firelight, Chayda heard a muffled cry. Tall Camille dropped to one knee, then fell face first onto the sand. Zaid came flying toward Melissa's opponent. She blocked the maiden's ebon blade and struck two fingers blindingly fast to the maiden's neck, then inside her thigh, shouting with each blow, so loudly that Chayda could feel them thump inside her chest. The second maiden went down, and Zaid rushed toward the third. Chayda could feel Zaid's heart pattering like a skin drum on Bet Rival, and the lack of rhythm was alarming. There were long pauses, then rapid, inconsistent beats. As Zaid charged, the next maiden shifted her stance, preparing her defense, but Sumeya and Melisse were ready. They quickly closed in and delivered two precise cuts, one to her side and one across the back of her leg. Indris knew she'd lost her chance. She ran to Camille's side, shouting, "Get up!" Camille, however, could do little more than roll her head from side to side. "Get up!" Zaid staggered back, breathing like an ox. Her heart was tripping over itself. Then she simply collapsed, her right hand over her chest. In the distance, northward, a horn sounded several distinct notes. It was the sort the king's navy ships used to call one another. To the south, the blast was repeated. It came a third time from the west. Chayda hadn't learned all their calls, but she knew this one. Converge. While Sumeya guarded against Indris, Chayda and Melisse cradled Zaid and carried her to the skiff. They lifted her inside, but their hold was tenuous and she slipped from Chayda's grasp and collapsed to the bottom of the skiff, striking her head against the thwart. Melisse leapt in and began hoisting the sail. Chayda helped Dardzada push and Sumeya was sprinting across the sand toward them.
"Get in,"
Chayda said to Dardzada. He ignored her and kept pushing, using his stout legs to move the skiff faster.
"Get bloody in,"
she shouted as Sumeya reached them. At last he relented, and soon they were sailing with speed. Indris had given up the chase. Camille was only just back on her feet, her legs wobbly as a newborn foal's. They spotted the moonlit sails of three other skiffs, but Chayda and Dardzada had taken the time earlier to plot their route out from the rocky oasis. Chayda used it now, skirting sections of stone carefully to keep their speed up. They sailed swiftly and soon had slipped free of the noose. Zaid and Dardzada were in a bad way, though. Zaid's heartbeat was still a strange pitter-patter, and her breath was coming in short, quick gasps. And Dardzada? Gods, his shoulder was a mess.
He'd been cut deeply. Blood soaked the front of his thorb, and the wound, lit by moonlight, had bits of white bone showing near the center. How he'd managed to push the ship at all was beyond her. Sumer and Melisse lay Dud Zada onto the bottom of the skiff. It was crowded, but his head fit between Zaid's legs. Then Sumer sat on the thwart, her legs straddling his chest.
"I'll need light,"
she said, grabbing the small bag where she kept her stitching thread and medical salves. It would be seen by the trailing ships, but there was nothing for it. Melisse struck a light and held it so that Sumer could see the mess the maiden's blade had made of Dad Zada's shoulder. She went to work, and Chayda guided them through the night. Chapter 51. Emre made his way to the gunwales of Tribe Kadri's capital ship, a caravel named the Autumn Rose. He carried his most trusted friend these past many days, a crude-looking but surprisingly powerful spyglass. For the part he had played in the battle with Onor, Emre had been asked aboard by Tribe Kadri's new sheikh, Mihir's young cousin, Ariz, a boy of only 14 summers. He was a handsome boy, though gangly and awkward at times. He had hazel eyes and a head of closely shorn hair, except for the braided tail that hung from the back of his head. Emre was glad to be on the same ship with him. He wanted to be able to gauge the young man's mood. Ariz had not yet committed to help the 13th tribe, but Emre still held out hope that he would. Lifting the spyglass to his eye, he completed the same ritual he conducted every hour over the past 10 days. He studied the horizon, noting any malformation, any cloud of dust, any misshapen cloud. He spotted movement 2 points off the port bow, but realized moments later it was only a flock of low-flying birds. Blazing blues, maybe, though what portent they might be, birds of peace that hadn't deigned to fly near their fleet, he wasn't sure. A dozen other times he had been sure he had spotted the hint of a sinuous body, lifting high into the sky and flying toward them like an eel through water. But it had only been his nerves. He couldn't shake the image of the worm's cold eyes as it had flown toward the ship. Most animals lived to feed and defend their territory or their young. The look in the sandworm's eyes had been malicious, as if it hungered to inflict harm. Emre had no doubt that Onor had summoned it using the strange orange stone, the one he'd used to crush Mihir's skull. Just how much control he had beyond that, Emre wasn't sure. What he was sure of was that he never wished to see the thing again.
"A choice now left to the gods," a voice inside him said.
"It's licking its wounds," said a woman's voice from behind him.
He turned to find Haddad leaning against the mizzenmast. She was holding a massive purple radish and was slicing pieces of it off with a small knife and popping them into her mouth. A peasant's meal, if he ever saw one. The sort of farmer in Malasan might have beside a burbling river before returning to work in the fields. She wore a bright dress made from a patchwork of colourful cloth. The stitching was rough, the pieces misshapen.
A peasant's dress to match her meal.
And yet, her many long necklaces, the silver bangles on her wrists, the large swaying earrings, somehow made her look as rich and stylish as any of the women from Golden Hill.
"You've come to see the sun," he said to her. "It's infernally hot down there," she said while chewing. "Why wouldn't I?"
She'd come aboard the Rose to be close to Ariz, but the loss of Zakhar and 2 more of her crew in the battle with Onor had struck her hard. She'd taken to staying in the bunk she'd been given below decks, rarely coming up to see the sun. Today, however, she seemed to have regained a bit of her old self. She had that crooked smile of hers that was equal parts chiding and endearing, and if her smile didn't quite reach her eyes, well, Emery could understand. He motioned with the spyglass to the rolling dunes behind them.
The worm was hardly wounded by the ballista bolt.
Wounded enough, it seems.
Perhaps, but I suspect Honor is holding it back until his ships can find us. No sense sending it out alone, where it might be crippled.
Haddad shrugged.
For all we know, it might be dead from infection. What good does it do to wonder over it now? Because the answer might mean our lives.
He waved his arm to the other ships that sailed alongside and ahead of the Autumn Rose.
All of our lives.
23 Kadri ships had escaped the battle. 2 had been abandoned due to damage sustained from the worm's acidic breath, leaving 21 ships in all, including the Autumn Rose, and Haddad's Dhow, Calamity's Reign. They'd been sailing ever since, hoping to stay ahead of Honor's fleet while heading for a meeting with the 13th tribe, should Emery convince Tribe Kadri to join them. Haddad shrugged again. She cut off a fresh slice from the radish and held it out for Emery. He shook his head.
It tastes like lizard vomit.
She shook it at him.
They help fight night coughs.
I'm not sick.
Again, she shook it.
Not yet.
She sounded like Emery's mother, what little he remembered of her. Hiding his smile, he took the piece and bit into the sharp, crunchy flesh. It wasn't so bad as he had made out, but he made a show of it anyway.
Baby,
Haddad said, hiding a smile. They sat their backs to the mizzenmast and finished the radish together. After a time, Emery asked the question that had been burning inside him for days.
What was Zakhar?
Haddad took some time before she responded.
He was my bodyguard.
I didn't ask what he did. I asked what he was.
She whipped the radish's inedible stem over the side of the ship.
Ask what you really mean to ask.
Was he a golem?
He was.
Who made him?
She turned to look at him in the eye, with an aggrieved expression on her face.
They aren't made, she said fiercely. Life is shared with them. Can...
He wasn't even sure how to ask it.
Can you make another?
Now she stood and rounded on him properly, stabbing the air between them with the knife she still held in her right hand.
Do you know anything about Malasan?
Feeling suddenly edgy, he stood as well. What could he say? He knew the Malasani people were brash and cocksure. He knew they had coveted Sharakai in the desert for generations. He knew of a cruel man who'd murdered his brother when he was young.
No. I cannot make another, Haddad went on. It's a sacred ritual. My brother gave his own blood, his own breath. He gave a piece of his soul that Zakhar might be my protector here in the desert.
He died to do this.
Haddad closed her eyes and took a deep breath. She adjusted her footing as the rose tipped over a dune.
No, he didn't die to give life to Zakhar. Golems are given life by those who grant it in a sacred ritual. Life is shared with them, not taken,
she said again. Then she went silent.
But Harin died 3 months later.
She shrugged, looking as lost as she had when they had fled Honor.
I was here in the Shangazi when it happened, but hoped to see him when I returned. I knew I was giving up much of my life in Malasan when I decided to treat with the tribes for my king. But I never thought I'd lose him so early. It may seem foolish to you, but Zakhar was my only remaining piece of him.
It's not foolish, Emery said. But Zakhar wasn't your last remaining piece of him.
She looked as though she were about to argue, so he quickly went on.
We are given the flames of our mother's love, and our father's, for as long as we might have them. So it is with everyone we meet. In the desert we say, they kindle us, and we kindle them. Our flames are exchanged. He waved a hand to her. The woman I see before me is not merely Hadad of Malasan. She is Hadad, and some small spark of her brother, and her family. And her friends, is it not so?
At this she seemed to soften slightly.
That's a facile notion.
Despite the words, a small portion of her smile returned.
But one I rather like.
The captain called for a northerly turn, and all over the ship the crew made ready. Emre and Hadad shifted over to the gunwales to make way.
The golem, Emre continued, is the car.
Hadad sighed.
And I was just beginning to like you. It's only...
He waved to the western horizon.
Onur.
He's a grave threat, and more dangerous than I give him credit for.
I would give anything to wipe him from the face of the desert. I would give my blood, if it would help. My breath.
She turned and stared into his eyes, as if trying to judge his sincerity. Then she looked away, crossing her arms beneath her breasts.
We would never share such things with a drylander.
She paused, and when she went on, it was with a softer tone.
And even if I wish to, it's not a gift I possess. You could try. I cannot simply try, you stupid Sharakani goat. It isn't will I lack, but the ability, the training. We lack the proper materials.
She waved, the simple motion somehow encompassing the whole of the desert.
Out here in this bloody wasteland. Now leave it be.
He had known it to be a desperate idea from the beginning, but these were desperate days. He was saved from saying more when the lookout in the ship ahead of them called,
Ship's ahead! 2 points off the starboard bow!
More called from nearby ships, confirming the sighting. Immediately the mood went from one of tight efficiency to unease. Everyone on these ships, including Emre, had been worried that Onur's ships would catch up to them. It seemed improbable that Onur could have raced ahead, but Emre had seen enough from Onur that he wouldn't discount it either. He stood on the gunwale and shielded his eyes from the relentless sun. He saw nothing immediately, but as the pilot eased the ships heading toward the starboard side, he spotted them. Dozens of ships in a cluster, their sails lowered.
They're not on oars,
their crewman called from the vulture's nest.
They're flying a blue pennant with a white device. A mountain peak?
Emre called up.
Aye, it might be.
A great joy welled up inside him.
It's the 13th tribe. It's Ishak and Masid.
Emre had underestimated just how much Tribe Kadri hoped to find the 13th tribe. All across the ship a cheer went up. The men and women on deck threw their hands to the sky. The cheer spread to other ships, all across their small fleet. It was so loud that their own spotter's calls were lost for a time. He was hanging like a fool from the vulture's nest atop the main mast, waving for the captain's attention.
Be quiet!
Emre called, dropping down to deck and waving them to silence.
Quiet! Ships aft! Ships aft!
The spotter, a thin stick of a man, called, pointing wildly to the desert behind the autumn rose. Everyone turned. When the ship took a rise, they came into view. Dozens of ships, a bit north of their current position, sailing on an intercept course.
Ships of the White Spear,
the spotter called.
King Onur's ships!
Sheikh Ariz moved aftward, along with the captain of the ship, a man named Ali Budrek, who had become something like Ariz's vizier. Behind them, Shal Alara came as well, her face grim.
"What shall we do?"
Ariz asked them all. Before the battle, he had been fifth in line to inherit the